surgical.
Absolutely. Right, we'll make a start. Welcome. Delighted to see you. We'll have the normal format today as opposed to yesterday when some of you came to a slightly different, more historical format with Peter Snow on the burning of the White House. I learned at last where the American National Anthem came from, which I suppose was I left the lunch better informed than I was when I arrived, so it was always a good thing. But today we are going to change that subject and go back to a more current and political subject. Before I introduce it, just let you know that next lunchtime, on Tuesday the 15th of July, our next lunchtime event will be Alan Duncan, who is the Minister of State for International Development. He's going to give a lecture entitled "The Arab Spring, Can Britain Piece It Back Together?" Alan, as you know, spent a lot of time in the Middle East before he came into politics, and much of the work he's done with the DOD has been, has been in relation to that part of the world. So I think we'll have a very interesting talk in relation to what is happening in that area at the moment. If you'd like to come, when Jacqueline sends out the invitations this week, can you let her know and we'll make arrangements. But today we're going to look at a much more current subject, one which has caused much debate not only in Parliament but also in the media, and that is the whole question of security versus privacy. It's been a subject which has always been bubbling during the whole of my political lifetime, but it came to life with the Snowden revelations last year. And it's in that context that we're very lucky to be able to debate that today with two very eminent speakers. The title we've given them is Whistleblowers, the Media and the Government, Who is in the Right? Maybe the answer is somewhere in the middle, but we'll learn more about that today. I'll introduce both our speakers now and then ask them to speak to us for about 15 minutes each, and then I'll open the event to questions and opinions from the floor. On my right, Sir Simon Jenkins, who's a journalist, an author, and currently chairman of the National Trust, although I think that finishes later in the year. But he's done an enormous amount of work on that front, as he has on other fronts in the more journalistic world in the past. He writes a column twice weekly for The Guardian, and weekly for the Evening Standard. He edited the Evening Standard and the Times. He was political editor of The Economist, and he worked on the Sunday Times as well. His latest book is England's Best 100 Views. But today I need to ask him to speak about, as I say, privacy and security. On my left we have Admiral Alan Lord West, who's a member of the advisory board of this organisation. I'm delighted he's agreed to take part in this debate today. I really probably don't need to introduce him because he's been introducing a series on Radio 4 on the Navy over the last 2 or 3 weeks, and some of us have been able to enjoy that during the course of the day. But I think the main points, he was promoted to Admiral in November 2000 when he became Commander-in-Chief Fleet, NATO Commander-in-Chief East Atlantic, and NATO Commander Allied Naval Forces. He led the UK's maritime response to 9/11, including the invasion of Afghanistan. He became First Sea Lord in September 2002, which he retired from on 7th of February 2006. He was a Minister for Security in the last government under Gordon Brown, so he sees it both from a military and a security perspective. So I'm going to ask him to speak second. But first of all, I'm going to ask Simon Jenkins if he'd like to address us.
Thank you very much indeed. Can I say how honoured I am to be debating with Alan? Come from my mother's side from a long line of naval officers. And my mother always said to me, whatever you do, never tangle with the Navy. They may get it wrong, but they're always the most intellectual of the services. So there we are. That's an appropriate preamble. I have almost no qualifications for standing here today and talking on this subject. I hesitate to say almost. As a journalist, one of the earliest events in my journalistic career was at the Sunday Times. It was the Spycatcher affair. And I think probably quite a few people here may remember it, judging by the colour of hair. It was, to a certain extent, I fear, my education in this general subject. It was not the happiest episode in the history of MI6. And it was even less happy an episode in the history of Downing Street. But to sit in a newspaper office and watch Her Majesty's Government make a complete ass of itself over a frankly pretty harmless book, purely because it was written by an ex-spy published in Australia. And the antics which poor Robert Armstrong had to go to under the instructions of partly Mrs. Thatcher, but partly the collective group of the security services really was pretty humiliating. And I rather felt for him, and I've got to know him since, and he was feeling humiliated. It persuaded me, or suggested to me, that there is a problem in an essentially closed service of any sort. It develops a professional ethos, a defensiveness, a determination to exclude outsiders of any sort, including outsiders who are there supposedly to monitor and control you in some sense. And then you can leave it to the politicians to make asses of themselves in your defence. It really was an extraordinary saga. Spin forward, slightly more relevantly, I write for The Guardian, to the Assange revelations, which I was slightly more closely involved in. Here you had an astonishing state of affairs with a mass of material pouring out of a leak into WikiLeaks from a rather tragic young man in the US Army in Iraq to a reckless, crazy individual, Julian Assange, with access to, in effect, the entire internet. Manning, the young man, had clearly decided he wanted to get this stuff out because he was shocked by it. It was not that shocking. It wasn't grade one secrecy, it was grade two or three secrecy. Most of it indicated either tactlessness on the part of State Department officials or recklessness on the part of Defense Department officials. It was essentially embarrassing material rather than what might be called state secrets. The problem with it, I do remember, was that a mass of it was potentially very damaging to individuals. And The Guardian, a huge amount of time and money was spent. And there was no question of refusing it. If we'd refused it, Assange would have put it all en clair, onto the web. So the only barrier between this security leak and catastrophe was us, was The Guardian. And an immense amount of time went into redacting this material, with some help from security officials, to the rage of Assange, who of course thought that, as far as he was concerned, I never forget one particular exchange in which somebody at The Guardian said, look, these are completely sincere, loyal agents within Iraq and Afghanistan who put their lives at risk to indicate to us what might be helpful. You're going to kill them. To which his reply was, it serves them right for collaborating. Now, our attitude was, that's not a sufficient answer. And eventually Assange broke with The Guardian and went wild. But I had no doubt in my mind this was what might be called good journalistic material. It did not endanger the security of the state, whatever that might mean in these circumstances. I might come on to that in a minute. But we did have a responsibility to individuals not to endanger their life, which I hope we honoured right through. Cut to Snowden, a totally different state of affairs. There is nothing in common, as far as I'm concerned, between Assange and Snowden, except the uselessness of security within the American intelligence community. It is useless. There's no other word for it. It does not exist. An email which has 2 million names on the list of access is not a secret. Whatever it is not a secret. It was amazing to me that it sort of wasn't out there anyway all the time. Most of it was so dull, which is probably the reason. In Snowden's case, after the Manning disclosures to Assange, the Pentagon said, this will never happen again. We are now going to install such firewalls throughout the system that an extraordinarily open system introduced after 9/11, for reasons that I imagine most people here are familiar with, will now cease. Absolute security will attach to this sort of material, including, in this case, diplomats' exchanges. It clearly didn't. This young man wasn't even working for the American government. He's working for an agency, working for a private contractor. He had complete access to it. He was quite unlike. Manning was a crackpot. Assange was mad. Snowden was not. He was a rather sincere, rather right-wing supporter of Republican. He was a Republican in favour of the Iraq War. He was simply shocked by what he saw. He was shocked by two specific things. One was that the National Security Agency was hacking into the entire internet. Whatever mechanism they could get to get into it, they used. And they were effectively, I use the word carefully, getting whatever they wanted and boasting about it with GCSE as their willing partner. He was simply shocked by this because the people into whom he was hacking either didn't know or had specifically said there was no risk of this happening. In other words, a deception was being perpetrated on the users of the internet on a truly massive scale. And he was shocked by that. But the second thing that really shocked him was that when they were challenged on it by Congress, his own bosses lied and lied and lied. And he simply said, this is unconstitutional. You're doing it as unconstitutional, and you're lying about it is even worse. And that's what broke Snowden out in Hawaii. He then proceeded to try and do something about it. Now, I would emphasize about this word whistleblowers. No whistleblowers are normal. Most whistleblowers are pretty weird. A number of people said to me after the Snowden revelations, but the chap should have had, you know, he should have had lunch with his boss in the club. I said, whistleblowers don't have lunch with bosses in clubs. They just don't, they're not like that. They're actually putting their entire life on the line. In his case, he'd seen what happened to Manning. He was genuinely convinced he'd either be killed or he'd be locked up for life. He was quite strange. He's a loner. And he gave the stuff to Glenn Greenwald in Brazil for on passing to The Guardian. He chose The Guardian because he thought that we'd redacted the material from Assange well. He was desperate for there to be no risk to American national security. His one sort of litany was that. There was effectively everything. I mean, everything that was being hoovered up could somehow or another, don't ask me how, be communicated to the outside world through one man working for an agency. And the problem The Guardian then had was they had a willing communicant of some material, a man frantic not to be able to be accused of endangering national security, which is obviously a moot concept, and a huge redaction problem, which in our case took the form of finding a trustee within the White House. Everything that appeared in the New York Times and The Guardian was passed through the White House. Most of their requests were acceded to. Only one or two of them weren't. And interestingly, the one or two that were not acceded to entirely dealt with the hacking into private company internet bases. They were terrified of losing these secret contacts with telecommunication companies in Europe in particular. Now, all I get from this is a sense that the crucial break here was twofold. One is the inability of these services, so big, so imperial, frankly, so arrogant, they couldn't believe, A, that what they were doing was wrong, and secondly, that there was any way in which they couldn't survive any subsequent crisis. It was a genuine sort of Jupiter complex, as they used to call it in the old days of the US Air Force. But secondly, a sort of feeling that provided they shut down totally and just said, everything you say about what we've done is a threat to national security, we can kind of hold the line. Interestingly, in America, it didn't hold the line. And despite all the blather and threats and nonsense, yesterday you'll have seen the new head of NSA saying, frankly, this was a security disaster as far as we were concerned. It's not a security disaster for America. It is not a very big deal, but we've got to do better next time. It was, I thought, a sane, sensible, moderate response to all this. In this country, people sidle up to me all the time and say, you don't know what damages has done. So I said, no, I don't know what damage has done. You don't know how damaging this has been. So I said, no, I don't know how damaging. I mean, does anybody know how damaging it is? No. I mean, it's asserted. We're back to Spycatcher. The club has closed ranks. And when the club closes ranks, I just simply know there's going to be another tragedy again because the club doesn't know how to close ranks. Sooner or later, if you effectively abuse the positions put in place to monitor security, those mechanisms will be breached. Now, my final point is just threefold. One is, I believe in secrets. I'm not a natural journalist. I'm sort of rather envious of spies at times. But I was one of the very few journalists who was a mild trustee in the old days of MI6. I had lunch with Colin McCall occasionally and David Spedding. I mean, I won't say they were friends of mine, but they liked to bounce off outsiders occasionally. I was a part of that world. I really didn't believe in avowal. I thought, if you've got a secret service, for God's sake, stay secret. They were so desperate to say to everyone, I'm a spy, that they craved publicity almost, Stella Remington in particular. But I believe in secrecy. I don't think you can conduct government any more than you can conduct a newspaper or the National Trust without a degree of loyalty and secrecy and confidentiality within the upper echelons of the service. But it's got to be plausible. So the second thing I think is that you've just got to have effective oversight of that mechanism in order to make it plausible. You've got to somehow believe that the things that you're doing, which in some sense or another are offensive to some people, including intruding into their privacy with warrant, and the word warrant is rather a good word, will survive scrutiny of an outside body, but again a loyal body, such as a parliamentary scrutiny committee or congressional in America. And these mechanisms have not proved effective. And in America, they now know it was totally ineffective. So there's got to be a relationship between secrecy and authorization and monitoring, which is plausible, carries public confidence. The last point I make is this. The word we come back to over and over again at the moment is terrorism. I think terrorism is a legitimate reason for warranted scrutiny of private electronic communications. It is not the same thing as national security. And the hijacking by the security community of the word terrorism and its alliance to national security is rubbish. Terrorists, on the whole, blow up bombs. They kill people, they destroy buildings, they are thorough nuisances, and it's the job of the police and others to try and track them down. They do not undermine the security of the state, which to my mind is national security. They're just not a national security threat. And the use made of that illegitimate connection between terrorism and national security to achieve a phenomenal self-aggrandizement of security budgets and so on is quite wrong. I beg to move. Thank you.
Well, Simon, thank you very much for a fascinating tour d'horizon. I suppose I would like to start from the assumption that our nation needs secret intelligence agencies, and that the clue as to how open they should be lies in the word secret, which you slightly alluded to. Their job is to discover information. It's often hidden, but it's important for our people's security, safety and prosperity. And we've moved quite a long way from the days as recently as 20 years ago, when the SIS was not even acknowledged by our government, to a situation where recently the heads of agencies were actually in front of the Intelligence and Security Committee in a public session. So we have made quite a lot of moves. And it's always been very important that there are adequate checks in place to ensure that the agencies behave in a manner that our nation expects of them. What I think is unhealthy is the desperate desire, particularly in some areas of the media, to see secrets and indeed decide what should be secret and what should not be secret. Apart from anything else, I think it shows an immense arrogance. Now, I know the days of thousands of those from Bletchley Park and the Y intercept stations keeping quiet about Enigma for some 25 to 30 years have long gone by, but I do believe the propensity for so many people today to divulge secrets about themselves and others on social media does seem very unfortunate, and in the case of national secrets, it is, of course, very damaging. So does the UK law balance privacy and security? And Simon touched on this. I believe it does, although I do think that more public debate about it is healthy. And I'm not going to talk, of course, for the NSA, which is a lot of what Simon was doing. I don't think I can. I don't know enough about it to do that. But the European Convention on Human Rights, Article 8, says everyone, and I read this, has a right to respect for his private and family life, his home, and his correspondence. There shall be no interference by a public authority with the exercise of this right, and then, except such as in accordance with the law and is necessary in a democratic society, in the interests of national security, the economic well-being of the country, and for the prevention of crime. Now, to ensure our agencies stick to the law, they are overseen by the Intelligence and Security Committee, which has a lot more clout than it used to, can actually demand things now. The Independent Commissioners for Oversight, that's the Intelligence Services Commissioner, and the Interception of Communications Commissioner, who have a lot of powers to go right down into the agencies and dig away in them, as well as the Investigatory Powers Tribunal. I believe we have one of the world's strongest legal and regulatory frameworks governing the use of secret intelligence. That certainly came home to me when I was a Minister for Counter-Terrorism and Security, travelling around the world, where I have to say in many countries there was almost no supervision of these things, and I was quite surprised. And I also think that our intelligence agencies take their obligations under the law extremely seriously. Now, Simon mentioned WikiLeaks. I wasn't going to go to that in any detail. I think it was amazing that a corporal has access to so many millions and millions of things. Of course, it's a thing called Cyprinet. The reason Cyprinet was brought in, pulling all these things together, was because the Americans were so bad at working out of the stovepipes, the CIA, DIA, NEMA, and the others. And they got it so wrong and so badly wrong, they had their heads knocked together and were told to work more closely. One of the things they did was throw all this lot together. Consequently, there's this immense pool of classified data, and a corporal could actually have access to it. Quite extraordinary, and I agree it's a security breach. And I also agree that Assange is a bit of a nutter, and actually a fugitive from justice. So I agree with Simon totally on that. But do Snowden's revelations show the government can't be trusted? I don't think they do. Sir Anthony May, who is the Interception Commissioner, he's confirmed that GCHQ operates within the law, having studied it after the Snowden result of the Snowden releases. And in case anyone would like to question Sir Anthony, I'm sure many of you know that he was one of the bench of judges that found against our government for the Binion Mohammed case. So he's not an apparatchik, someone we can push around. He is actually a free thinker on these things. Now, PRISM was the great thing that was mentioned, this ability to go and look at all sorts of data. It was mentioned by Simon. And following the allegations that GCHQ had broken British law in receiving PRISM material, the Intelligence and Security Committee conducted a review. They concluded, from the evidence we have seen, we conclude that this is unfounded. We've received the reports that GCHQ produced on the basis of intelligence sought from the US, and we are satisfied that they conformed with the GCHQ's statutory rights. The legal authority for this is contained in the Intelligence Services Act of 1994. And further, in each case where GCHQ sought information from the US, a warrant for interception signed by a minister was already in place, in accordance with the legal safeguards contained in the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act, RIPA 2000. Sir Anthony May looked at the same question, and he said, British intelligence agencies do not circumvent domestic oversight regimes by receiving from US agencies intercept material about British citizens, which could not lawfully be acquired by intercept in the UK. Now, turning to the scale of interception, bulk interception, and I know this worries people in this country, is not mass surveillance. And there are very strict rules set out in law allowing only a small proportion of material that is intercepted to be examined, and only when it is necessary and proportionate to do so. There's always the requirement for these things. And UK law permits bulk interception of external communications where at least one end is overseas, and I can ask more about that in questions if people want to know. All of it under warrants, and there has been loose talk saying they haven't had warrants for it, but they have. But of course, all GCHQ look at are the envelopes, that's how I like to describe it, not the content. They look at the outside of these messages. They don't go down into them. Any part of a URL, that's the web page address, after the first slash is considered to be content under UK law. And so there have to be very specific rules of going to a minister, get approval to actually look at that content. What they're looking at in this bulk, looking at things, is addresses, rather like on the outside of an envelope that you will see lying around, to see where it was sent from, where it's going to. And that allows, of course, one can make links and pull together things. You know, why is it Simon is constantly talking to Al-Awlaki, the bomb maker in Yemen? You know, it does make you just wonder a bit. You would then have to go to a minister to get approval, maybe to look at what they're saying to each other. And it could be that they're debating something to do with English heritage, in which case we stop looking at it. It's as easy as that. If only... private companies were as punctilious. And I find it quite amazing in this debate that we don't actually look at things like form and all those sorts of things where private companies go down looking into all of our emails. The reason, if you like yachting, for example, you constantly get yachting adverts is because people are going into your emails and picking out keywords. And I think that is a disgrace. The fact the government does it under warrant, I think, is appropriate for the things we've described already, but not for private companies. So what about Snowden himself? Well, I don't actually see him as a whistleblower. And there is a place for whistleblowers, and they are often strange chaps, as Simon says. I don't believe he'd exhausted all his options, notwithstanding what Simon said. For example, why didn't he go to Congress, flanked by the editor of The Guardian and The New York Times, as Sir David Oman suggested when he was recently quizzed in Parliament? If someone who said he wanted to expose wrongdoings at the Bank of England decamped with a few million pounds to a country we had no extradition treaty with, I think it would raise a few doubts in my mind, I must say. To my mind, I'm afraid Snowden is a traitor, despite all of what Simon says, and how extraordinary to see him first in China, the world's greatest cyber hackers, without a doubt, they do it on an industrial scale every day, and then to Russia, so well known for their open society and lack of state surveillance. There are three main areas of damage from Snowden's disclosure, and Simon is right, it's very difficult to actually quantify all these. The first, I believe, is individual intelligence targets changing their communications methodology. I mean, that stands to reason. None of us are stupid. If we knew suddenly how someone was looking at our material, we would change it. And that has happened. The fact that the US internet service providers are introducing end-to-end encryption and moving offshore to ensure that only they can benefit from the data sent by their users, because they do look at some of this material. And again, that means there's less access for our people if we want to look at people who wish to do us harm. And finally, operations which were ongoing where we've had to stop doing them. So I'm afraid I have to say that there is no doubt in my mind that Snowden has made us all less safe, but exactly how less safe is quite difficult to quantify. I do just want to quickly mention the draft communications data bill. I've got time, I think, haven't I, Mike, for that, because I think it is a really important thing. This is the requirement, really, of our police primarily to look at communications data. It used to always be phone data, saying, you know, where someone phoned from, did they use their mobile phone in such and such a place, who are they calling up, which is used in 95% of the serious cases and prosecutions. Now, that data, it used to be kept because that was the way the phone companies charged. Because of all the new ways of communicating now, new ways of costing, they no longer will have to do that. And if they're not doing it, we will not have access to that. And the Communications Data Bill wants to actually allow us to get access to those bits of data again. There was a draft bill produced. It was put up and it was looked at by a joint committee of the House. The Joint Committee of the House said we're not happy, and there are a whole raft of things they weren't happy with. Basically, the government took that away, redrafted the bill, and took in all of those points. And both the Joint Committee now, that they've looked at this draft, and the Intelligence and Security Committee agree that there is an absolute case for legislation. And it will ensure that communications data required by the police and others continues to be available in the future. And I'm sure that ought to be done. It's been held up for political reasons. On a day-by-day basis now, it is making us less able to do things that I think we should do for our good in this country. An awful lot of it is to do with, this is crime more than terrorism and things like that. And I hesitate to mention it, rather like shouting terrorist all the time. There is an awful lot of paedophilia involved in this area, because an awful lot of the paedophilia cases involve computers, and we are finding it more and more difficult to actually prosecute those. So I do think that's important, and that's why I wanted to mention it. I briefly want to mention CCTV. Everyone's schizophrenic. When I was a minister, in a general sense, no one wanted a CCTV. Why the hell should people watch us? They're snooping. When something happened, they wanted it on their train station, on the stairs going up, and outside the house. So, it's quite an interesting one. But I agree totally with what Simon says about terrorism. Terrorism is not an existential threat to our nation, and it won't be until terrorists get an improvised nuclear device. And let's hope they don't ever get one of those. He's rather like my great aunt, who, when I became the Minister for Security, I appeared on television and said, this is a terrible threat, we've got to do this or another. She phoned me up and she said, Alan, she said, we were being bombed every night in London, 60,000 of us died and we still danced at the Ritz. So I realised there was a different view of some, a perception of some of these things. So I've spoken too long. I suppose my parting shot would be that I see the agencies as allies. They're full of very good patriotic men and women working extremely hard, sometimes risking their lives for the good of our nation. They're part of our nation. They're not an alien force. Clearly, we've got to regularly review oversight mechanisms, but I would trust them on my right hand in a fight, and I believe the majority of our countrymen, and indeed Simon, feel the same. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alan. I'm now going to open it to the floor. Before I do so, I'm just going to make one comment which might create an added perspective. The Intelligence and Security Committee has been mentioned on occasions. I have the honour to serve on that committee, and it is true that we look